Hey everybody, welcome to Tell Your Friends, the only podcast that matters, our very first midweek bonus episode. Don't sweat, don't worry, we will be back next Sunday with a regular format episode. We'll be talking to actor, author, podcaster Stephen Tobolowsky, and we'll have a road story from musician Mike Doty, and we will also take another trip down Ted Travelstead's story hole. So don't go nowhere. That's this Sunday at 9 p.m. It becomes available for download. Okay, so as I said, this is a bonus episode. This is a live recording of a show called Novelization, a reading show based on the major motion picture. Features hosted by and produced by myself, Marlo Riley, and Heidi Vanderly, and it features some of our funny friends reading from novelizations based on major motion pictures. We've got Maggie Sirota from the Low Times podcast and The Best Show on WFMU. She'll be reading from Rocky IV. We've got Onion editor Joe Garden reading from Ghost Dad. We've got Onion editor Todd Hansen reading from Saturday Night Fever. And we've also got TV's Frank Conniff from Mystery Science Theater 3000 reading from Krull. Our next live show will be at Union Hall, where we recorded this one with Mike Doty, Bethany Hall, Marlo, Heidi, and myself, and one or two other readers. Still TBA. Tickets are only $7. You can buy them at unionhallny.com. Okay, so before we get started, I feel like I should explain one more thing, which is to record this for a podcast, we patched my Zoom portable recorder into the soundboard so we could have a clean just soundboard recording, and then it was still set to record through the Zoom's built-in mic. So the good news is the Zoom has some pretty badass mics, and we caught everything, but the soundboard is in the back of the room next to the bar. So at points, the loudest thing in the recording are the cash register and people ordering drinks. That's just the way it is. Also, apparently Todd Hansen was sitting under a microphone. So occasionally you will hear him laughing and clapping and just being Todd Hansen, which is a lovely thing to be. You can follow Tell Your Friends at TYF Podcast on Twitter. And you can visit us for more information at tyfpodcast.com on the World Wide Webs. And without any further ado, take it away. Me, Marlo, Heidi, Tell Your Friends, the only podcast that matters.
Show Pretty in Pink. How you doing, Union Hall? That was fucking tepid and awful. How are you doing, Union Hall?
We're in this fucking dress. You could just at least applaud.
Give it up for in the prom dress right here, Heidi Vanderly. And to my right, Mr. Marlo Riley. I know, I'm not quite that bad. I am not bad with names. I'm Leah McAdini. It took way too long to get that. I'm really mad at everybody in the room.
He's probably the only professionally funny person up here.
Well, we'll see. Time will tell. We're doing a reading series tonight.
Yeah, so this was a result of all of us doing nothing on a Sunday morning and just hanging out on Facebook and bragging.
Facebook is my full-time job. How dare you?
I mean, it's true. I was just saying I was upset that I slept until noon today because I woke up and realized I'd probably missed a lot of the internet. I was really upset. We were bragging about our novelizations that we owned, which is a weird thing to brag about.
Well, Marlo
I think I got to do a challenge with Liam about Grease and Grease 2.
Marlo posted a picture of Grease 2, the novelization, on Heidi's Facebook wall.
I was horrified.
And I immediately saw that because I have nothing better to do than monitor Facebook. And I was like, holy shit, I have the novelization of Grease literally a foot away from my head at this very moment. So I posted a picture of me holding it on her Facebook wall. And turned into a reading show. That's how you do professional comedy, everybody. That's how the movie Battleship came up together.
Yeah, so basically have nothing better to do, and you come up with ideas like this.
And you guys have nothing better to do than come watch us do this, so... And Heidi in a dress.
I don't wear... I wear dresses a lot. What are you talking about?
But we have like a really stellar lineup of readers tonight. In addition to us, we also have from WFMU and the Load Times podcast, Miss Maggie Sirota. We have two of the original Onion editors, Todd Hansen and Joe Garden. And reading from the movie, the book of the movie, Kroll, we'll have TV's Frank Conniff.
And finishing it out, we'll have the inimitable Handjob Academy.
Don't try to imit them. They are inimitable.
Yeah, I like that word a lot.
It is a good word. And so what we're going to do is we're going to be coming up and introducing the readers and each other. But right now I'd like to introduce our first reader to the stage. She'll be reading from a book of what I think is a favorite movie among a lot of people in this room. Everyone in this world. It made $1 billion? No, I'm sorry. Ladies and gentlemen, please give it up for your first reader tonight, the lovely dress-wearing Heidi Vanderlee.
So, Pretty in Pink. This is a movie I saw when I was probably 10 years old. My parents didn't ever let me watch anything that was over, like, PG or something. I don't know what the fuck they thought I was... I just didn't know anything about anything. So, a friend brought Pretty in Pink over to our house for a sleepover, and it was, like, totally a big secret. Like, oh my god, we're watching a PG-13 movie. I'm, like, 9 years old. Holy shit. And the thing is, by that time, it was already the mid-90s, so what they were wearing looked pretty fucking weird already. And I remember just being really confused by anyone finding anyone else in the movie attractive. I just didn't get it at all. But now, in hindsight, it's one of my favorite movies of all time, and probably one of my first crushes that made me feel really strange and told me a lot about my life afterwards, the Ducky Dale. I mean, so I'm going to read a scene that I think sums up Ducky and Andy's relationship pretty well. This scene... Andy's bedroom. Ducky Dale was in heaven, or the closest thing to it he could imagine. It was dark outside, and he was in Andy Walsh's room, sitting on Andy Walsh's bed, with Andy Walsh herself sitting cross-legged, not 2 feet from him. She had no choice. Every other inch of available space in the room was covered with something. Now, this is two paragraphs describing her room. Old clothes were heaped around jewelry, ribbons, hats, shoes. There were magazines and books everywhere. Flaky old magazines, bright, shiny new ones, huge faded secondhand books, lavishly illustrated library tomes on fashion, art, and design. The walls were brimming with posters and fashion illustrations, and photographs torn out of magazines and charcoal drawings tacked and taped up between flowing bright scarves and belts and an old kimono and a man's flannel bathrobe with an ancient braided silk rope dangling from its belt loops. There are no commas in that. That's awful. So basically, there was nowhere else for the two of them to sit except on Andy's bed. And there was nothing separating them but Ducky's homework, which Andy was reading with obvious dismay. She looked up. "Ducky," she said. "The Warsaw Pact is a treaty signed by the Soviet Union and its 7 East European satellites. It established a mutual defense organization as a counterweight to NATO." Ducky released the pillow he'd been holding. Actually, he'd been cradling it in his arms, stealing an occasional secret sniff of the lingering scent of her cologne. "What I put," he said. "You wrote, 'The Warsaw Pact is the pact that's named after Warsaw.' And a teacher's going to know you're trying to fake it." Okay, you're right, Ducky admitted. What about the rest of it? The Russian Revolution did not take place in Germany. What was Karl Marx then? He said. Was he German or what? He was a German. Okay, Ducky said. But his being German doesn't have anything to do with where the Russian Revolution occurred. He stared at her, waiting. She stared at him and shrugged. This is great exposition. Good point, he said. Andy set the paper down. Ducky, can I propose something to you without you getting mad? He looked up at the ceiling. That depends, he said. On what? He looked at her. I don't know. I just said that. Just for, go ahead. I propose that you're deliberately flunking your classes, Ducky, so that you can stay in high school. It was as if she'd punched him. He exhaled hard. He reddened, and Andy realized she'd never seen him embarrassed before. That's totally absurd, Ducky said, fast and defensively. Why would I do that? Her heart ached for him. I don't know. Tell me. I'm not, so there's nothing to tell you. You're not always one to face things, Ducks. Oh, since when? What am I not facing? The future, Andy said softly. He ran his fingers along the seam of her pillowcase. Whether or not you face the future, it happens, right? He said. You run yourself down. Why? I'm not running myself down. He shook his head. Do you think I'm running myself down? I don't think I'm running myself down. Why? Because of my clothes? He asked her pillow. No way. Because why? Because I can laugh at myself. That's called a sense of humor. You should get one. They're nice. Grateful for his grin, Andy reached out and put her hand behind his neck. She pulled him toward her until their foreheads touched. What are we going to do next year? She asked, feeling suddenly blue. According to you, Ducky said, I'll still be in high school. I'm serious, Duck. Not a day in 8 years have passed when I didn't see you or talk to you. Devotion, babe, Ducky said sadly. Andy pulled back and kissed his forehead. I hope I'm not the only one who knows what an incredible person you are. At this point in time, I'm afraid you are. Andy laughed, and she hugged him and felt him shiver suddenly. She stood up with a determined sigh. Okay, you're getting an A on this paper, Duck, if it takes all night. I'm going to get you something to drink, then we work. What do you want? Beer, scotch, juice box, whatever. She left the room. Ducky stared at the door for a moment. There was a teary feeling in his gut and in his throat. He let out a deep breath, stood up, and wandered through the wonderful mess of Andy's room. At the dresser, he picked up her hairbrush. I love this woman, he told the brush. He looked at himself in the mirror. I love this woman, and I have to tell her, he said. If she laughs, she laughs, but I can't wait anymore. He saw the torn photograph stuck in the mirror frame. He'd seen it there before, and he knew who the girl in the prom dress was. If she doesn't love me, he told that girl, then she doesn't love me. But if I don't find out... Ducky shrugged. The girl in the prom dress watched him with her mysterious smile. How could you have left her? And just, side note, Andy's mom left her. She's a jerk. Ducky asked suddenly, I'd never have, never. She looked over his shoulder and then turned back to her and continued in a confidential whisper. But don't worry about it, okay? She's fine. She's going to be all right. I'll take care of her. I love her so bad. He held the brush up to his mouth like a microphone and began to hum a 50s tune. Remember that one? He said to the photograph. Bet they sang it at your prom, right? Well, this one's for you. Ducky whirled away from the mirror. And for all you hard-traveling mothers out there. He sang into the hairbrush mic and grabbed one of Andy's hats off a wall hook. It was a wide-brimmed man's hat, and it flopped down over his ears. He pushed it to the back of his head and continued dancing through the room until he caught a glimpse of himself in the closet mirror and stopped suddenly. She's gonna laugh at me, he said. He looked at the hairbrush in his hand. I can't blame her. He tossed the hairbrush onto her bed and took off the hat. Ducky walked into the kitchen with school books under his arm. Andy had popped a Coke for herself and she was stabbing a straw into a juice box for him. I'm gonna split, he told her. What about your paper, she asked, surprised. That's what I'm gonna do. He looked down at his feet. Not that he could have avoided looking at them. They were everywhere, covered half the kitchen floor, didn't they? I'm going to do it myself, he told Andy. I mean, if you help, it'll be bogus. It won't be my work. He looked up at her. You're right, he said. I'm messing up too much. He took the juice box from her. I'll catch you in the AM. Ducky took a sip. Drinking and driving don't mix. That's why I ride a bike.
You get a four speed on the floor, never waiting at the door. You know that ain't no shit, where they get lots of tin trees light them.
I will be reading about novelizations is that, like, they're pretty much written by guys whose entire artistic motivation is they need $5,000 really quickly. Like, I always imagine whenever I see one that it's, like, some guy who's, like, a fucking drug addict or, you know, like, just, like, oh, shit, my mortgage is due yesterday. Battery's not included. I can do bang that out in a week. Novelization for a movie I have never seen, but I own. Same with the movie Last Starfighter. I've read the book. I've never seen it. And the same with the book that I am reading tonight. Now, novelization is, like, ridiculous because it's essentially a book with movie stills, and that's what their target audience wants, is fucking movie stills in the middle. This is doubly ridiculous because it's the book for the movie Grease. Which, I don't know if you know, is a musical. Like, no fan of Grease is like, oh, the way that John Travolta and Olivia Newton-John got inside their characters. There was some De Niro-esque fucking method acting going on there. And you're like, well, how would the book for the movie Grease incorporate the lyrics into the story? And the answer is the writers didn't even try, which is great. That's strike one. Strike two, this is clearly written, and maybe I'm reading a little too much into it, but I really got the feeling reading this book that this was a guy who was like, I am a serious novelist. And I know, even though I'm not getting paid for this, a lot of people are going to read this book. So they're going to see my talents on display in getting inside the characters' heads. So it's written from multiple points of view. I wish I could read the whole book to you guys. I wish we had time tonight. I'm going to read chapter 13. And I say you could literally flip to any page in this book and get something golden out of it. So that's what I did. I literally flipped to any page in this book. Chapter 13. Me, Danny, and Roger were cruising the back streets, stripping parts from parked cars as a present for Kaneki's greased Lightning. That's Lightning with an apostrophe. He dropped the G, so you know he's street tough. We got 4 baby moons from a Chevy, a chrome mirror from a Chrysler, and a pair of big sponge dice from a black Buick. Roger copped an aerial from a big-ass caddy, but decided to keep it for himself as a weapon. You could really give someone red stripes with that thing. If someone pulled out a car and said, get back! I'm not a tough guy. I would laugh my ass off. Leo and the Scorpions had us all a little on edge since our run-in with them at the bonfire, so we kept one eye peeled in case they tried to sucker us from behind. Again, this is a summer fun musical that was on Broadway. In the meantime, we were collecting weapons for ourselves, getting ready in case the Scorpions called us out. We weren't really fighters. Really? You had a car antenna for a weapon? You weren't really a fighter? In fact, we prided ourselves on being lovers and fleet-footed runners. And all the time I was in the T-Birds, which was from the beginning, we were never in a gang fight. As a founding officer of the T-Bird organization, we just gave everybody the impression that we spent I've seen the movie. You gave everyone the impression you spent a lot of time in Chorus Boys' fucking dressing rooms rehearsing. We just gave everybody the impression that we spent most of our time kicking ass, so nobody screwed around with us. But it was no lie, we were never in a big fight. Now all of a sudden, I found myself working on a zip gun in machine shop, and I wasn't doing so good on it because I didn't know the first thing about a gun, and I couldn't even ask anybody for help. I wasn't even sure if it would work, but I figured as long as it looked like a gun, it would amount to the same thing. I really wasn't about to shoot anybody. Really? With a homemade zip gun that you've never used a gun before? I just figured I could get some nice results without ever having to fire it. But lately, things had been quiet, almost too quiet.
Yeah!
We stopped by Skippy's. Really, you had a guy named Skippy in your gang and you weren't tough guys? We stopped by Skippy's and picked up some beer. Then headed for the corner with the suds and our take for the night. Kanicki was waiting for us behind the wheel of Greased Lightning. I'm guessing this is where you have a song number. He had his legs stretched out on the dashboard with his back leaned against the door. He looked like he was getting ready to fall asleep. Yo, Kanicki! I yelled. We got presents for you. Yeah, Danny said. Open your mouth and close your eyes. Again, a summer fun musical that most of you got drunk and sang at karaoke at some point. Considering how much talking you've been doing, I am not surprised. Hey, not in your life, Knick said, sitting up. We gathered around the car with our hands behind our backs. In turn, we put the mirror, hubs, and dice on the hood of the car. Christ! Knick jumped out of the car. He looked carefully at each of the items. Hey, you guys, he said. These hubcaps ain't got a scratch on them. They must be worth 2 beans apiece, you see. Knick, Roger said, we ain't giving them to you to sell, shithead. They're for Greased Lightning. We figured since we're all going to be knocking off a piece at one time or another in her, we felt like we'd chip in and help you fix her. Ah, jeez, fellas, I'm touched, really. This moves me beyond words. He shrugged his shoulders and rolled his head from side to side. What can I say? ... Me and Greased Lightning are truly humiliated. And we both thank you guys from the bottom. We each grabbed the hubcap and slapped it on a wheel while Kanicki hung the dice on the door since he didn't have a windshield or a rearview mirror. One thing at a time. That's a very important motto. One thing at a time. The windshield wasn't going to be an easy take. It required some planning. Or a job. A little engineering to say the least. Kanick put the mirror on his glove compartment until he had a windshield to put it on. We were standing back admiring our work when we heard a siren in the distance. That meant either one of two things. Either the cops was going to collect money. What? Or somebody had discovered parts of their car missing. We jumped into Greased Lightning and took off, and that is the end of the 2.5-page paragraph from Grease. And now, to read from the sequel.
Yes!
You know him, you love him. Mr. Marlowe Riley, everybody.
In case you're not familiar with Grease 2, it's the same story as Grease. Except, the gender is flipped around. So Michael is the one who is the outsider and the goody-goody. And Stephanie, Michelle Pfeiffer's first role, was the... What?
Stephanie Zanoni.
Exactly. She's the leader of the Pink Ladies at the time, so here we are. Dolores gave the sidewalk another push with her left foot and angled her skateboard into the parking lot of the Bolorama Ladies. She immediately spotted Balmuto aside his motorcycle, engine running, but with none of the other cycle lords in sight. Dolores raised her chin and looked as regal and cool as possible as she sailed right by, deftly avoiding a beer bottle. Her forearm was raised in the classiest of defiant gestures. Creep, she said under her breath. She hopped off at the alley door, scooped up her skateboard, and pushed inside without looking back. Balmuto raised his arm and snapped his fingers. Dolores trotted into the echoing bowling alley and looked quickly around. She spotted her sister, Paulette, getting some drinks at the counter, and the rest of the pink ladies in a booth just behind the pinball machine where three of the T-Birds were assembled. She ran over to them and announced breathlessly, "Balmudo's out front and he's all alone." Noga really heard her, but his expression didn't change. He leaned hard into the pinball machine and pounded on the side. The machine lit up. "Tilt! Tilt," Goose said. "My turn." Noga really turned away lazily. "Your turn after we tilt that crater-faced Balmudo." He started for the door. "Come on with me." Goose abandoned the pinball machine and joined Amici as they all strutted out of the restaurant area, playing it very tough, sliding through the crowd. The pink lady slid out of the booth and followed. "You stay here," Paulette said to her sister, who didn't listen to her. Noga really stopped just before the exit, holding out a hand. "Comb," he said. Noga really combed his hair carefully, giving the spit curl one last twist. He handed back the comb and said, "Smoke." Goose was ready for him. "Light," Noga really said, waiting. Demucci flipped his Zippo and ignited the end of Johnny's drooping cigarette. The T-Bird leader insolently blew out a cloud of smoke but resumed his advance. The three T-Birds burst out through the doors into the parking lot and stopped. 15 Cycle Lords sat astride their bikes in a semicircle around the door, with Balmudo in the middle, grinning viciously. "Comb again," Noga really said. They all pulled out combs and stepped back quickly through the still-moving door. Dolores had started to run for the side exit, knowing that Paulette would ground her if she saw her go out to the front. But she ran into Davey Jaworski coming out of the men's room. She grabbed his arm. "Come on, action out front," she exclaimed. "What? Balmudo is going to get his face mangled." They started back towards the front doors, pushing through the group of bowlers trying to get a look. Because they were short, neither Davey nor Dolores saw the rest of the T-Birds back inside, or the other side of the wide entrance. Davey shouted through the door belligerently, yelling out, "Where's that rat-faced Balmudo?" His voice died and he gulped. He stared off at the semicircle of bikers. They were all off on their bikes and advancing towards the bowling alley. Balmudo reached out and grabbed Davey's jacket, throwing him hard against the door frame. The other cycle lords marched in slowly, savoring the moment. A chain jingled in a gloved hand. A switchblade clicked open. A gloved fist smacked into a gloved palm. Then there came the roar of a powerful engine from the alley, and a cycle lord snapped his head around. He saw only a blur as the headlight flashed on, reflecting off the cyclist's goggles. The machine thundered in, striking between Davey and Balmudo, making them both shrink back. "What the hell?" the lord exclaimed. The mystery biker whipped his machine sideways and stopped. He looked back and seemed to dare the lords to chase him. "Who the hell is that?" one of the gang growled, rolling a chain around his fist. "Get that guy," Balmudo ordered. The lords scrambled up to get aboard their bikes and rev them up. The mystery biker rolled slowly and insolently out of the lot and gunned it into the street as the deep-throated roar of the pack sounded. "Who the hell was that?" Davey muttered. Michael Carrington grinned under his helmet, then twisted the grip, bringing the engine noise to a screaming pitch. The cycle lord shot out of the lot like watermelon seeds spit into the night. They yelled as they burned rubber in pursuit. The T-Birds came out and joined Davey in the lot, shaking from the near disaster of 4-15. "He just shot out of nowhere," Davey said, pointing. Just blazing by like a rocket pilot." "That's some kind of natural-born bike jockey," Goose said. "He burned up the pavement with those wheels of his." The cycle lords all took a corner sharply, slanted over and firing high. "He's looking for a rumble," one of the lords shouted. "And he came to the right party." "He's gonna do a header," another yelled, raising his fist to the sky. "With one punch of the steel." "The only thing you guys are going to do," shouted the pink ladies in the parking lot, "is eat his dust." If I remember correctly, this is actually a song. "Who's that guy?" they all asked each other and shrugged. "Where did he come from?" Paulette asked. "Who can that crazy dude be?" Sharon muttered. "Hey," Noga really growled. "Who's this new kid on the block, huh? Spill it. Any of you guys know?" "Nope," Goose said, giving Sharon a dark look. Then he squinted in the direction of the fading sounds. "I wonder who..." A cycle lord yelled across to his buddy as they streaked through an intersection following the mystery cyclist's taillights. That joker's got some hot machine, he admitted reluctantly, but it ain't hot enough for the lords. Cycle lords raced across a vacant lot into an alley and thumped out into the street, causing a car to screech to a stop. We're gonna wrap those handlebars around that neck of his, Almuto bowed loudly. The punk will get it. Some of you may not be able to tell who the mystery biker is, but I'll leave that a mystery. Next up is, as we said earlier, Maggie Sirota from WFMU and Low Times with Tom Sharpling, and she will be right back.
Well, it looks like it's up to me to inject some testosterone into this evening. I am from an obscure East Coast city called Philadelphia. And it's a little city, big chip on the shoulder. And I am from a neighborhood called South Philly. And thank you. And are you my cousin? So I'm from a neighborhood called South Philly, and it's also the neighborhood of a fictional boxer named Rocky. Now, I don't know how well you can see this. It's just Sylvester Stallone draped in the American flag. For reference point, Sylvester Stallone is 5'8", which is my height. His co-star in the movie was a Danish actor named Dolph Lundgren. Playing the Russian powerhouse Ivan Drago, who's like 6'5", the size of like a fucking building. So when Sylvester Stallone has to, you know, like basically end the Cold War with his fists, like he's coming up to like Dolph Lundgren's like sternum. And there's a lot I can say about all the Rocky movies, but I only have 8 minutes. So something you need to understand about all the Rocky movies is that there is a montage. There's usually a pretty long montage. It's the training sequence. And I'm going to talk to you about the montage in Rocky III. Okay. So it's when Apollo Creed and Rocky have flipped aside their differences, and they've built a very deep friendship. And if you don't know who Apollo Creed is, I swear to fucking God, I will Ian McKay you. I will give your $5 back and throw you out. So there's a very long training montage, and the only word that can be used is frolicking. It's the only appropriate word. It's two buff glistening men, the great Carl Weathers, the greatish Sylvester Stallone, are frolicking down a beach, holding hands and jumping in the ocean together, waves gently crashing around them. Okay, so I want that image in your mind as I read this prologue to Rocky IV. It's credited to Sylvester Stallone, but given the Cold War propaganda, I think maybe Alexander Haig or Caspar Weinberger wrote this. But okay, so here's where we start. There was still the favor to Apollo, but it hadn't been completely over. The water from the shower collected around his feet and swirled down the rusty drain. Rocky heard Apollo turn off the shower in the cubicle beside him. How much do you want to bet in the first draft there was no cubicle? Like it was... The favor. In all the time Rocky had known Apollo Creed, he had never completely understood him. He had been in awe of him, marveled at him, fought him, been beaten by him, but never understood him. There was only one Apollo. He was complex and unique. The favor was not really a surprise, because anything that comes from a surprising person is bound to be unusual. They met at Gold Mill's gym. It had been closed since Mickey's death. No, I woke Ian McKay you again, but just for background, Mickey... He's killing you, Rocky. He's killing you. It's the great Burgess Meredith. God rest his soul. Thank you. The gym was still tomb-like. Its inhabitants had unhappily dispersed to other gyms around the city, but they weren't the same. There was only one Gold Mills. The dreams of sweat and blood that lingered in the gathering dust of the gym were not transferable. Kind of like the fucked up interest rates in my credit card. The old dented locker doors slammed shut as Rocky and Apollo finished putting on their boxing outfits. You know, I can't believe you're doing... Wait, I'm sorry. Let me take two. You know, I can't believe you're doing this, Rocky said as they headed out of the locker rooms. We made a deal, Apollo replied. Yeah, but this is extremely crazy. Yeah, mentally irregular, Apollo agreed. They walked through the deserted gym to the well-worn ring. A shaft of moonlight shone down through the skylight, illuminating the ring. Rocky could almost hear the heavy breathing of phantom boxers as they struggled with jump ropes, speed bags, and medicine balls. But it all makes sense. But it makes all the sense it needs to, Apollo stated. You owe me a favor, right?
Yeah, when did you think of this?
About 3 years ago.
This is crazy.
The last time we met, you were lucky. You beat me by 1 second. Now that is hard for a man of my intelligence to handle.
But didn't you say you learned to be happy after losing to me?
Apollo's smile was wide and mischievous. I lied. Rocky nodded his head, understanding.
So you just gotta know for yourself.
Just for myself, Apollo repeated. Rocky nodded his head Rocky jumped up on the ring canvas, then reached down a helping hand and pulled Apollo up.
Go slow. You're not as young in springtime no more, Rocky warned.
Young enough to whip your butt.
How can you win? You taught me all your tricks.
Apollo laughed. Not everything. Rocky smiled. He felt as good as he had the first time he put on a pair of gloves years ago. Stallion? I want you to remember that you might fight great, but I'm a great fighter. Ready?
Absolutely.
They moved to the center of the ring and began circling. All over the country, kids were picking up baseball gloves, adjusting shoulder pads, putting on boxing gloves, getting set to run out the kitchen door in pursuit of excitement, challenges, and victories. Too bad we gotta get old, Stallion.
Just keep punching, Rocky said.
They moved towards each other, smiling, their arms cocked and ready. Simultaneously, each unleashed a devastating punch that rocks the other's head. Thank you. Yes! Next up, we have Joe Garden, who is an editor for The Onion and ThingX.tv, presenting Mr. Joe Garden.
Good evening.
Hooray!
Before I read for my selection, I just have a few factoids I'd like to share with you. Two of them are about Pretty in Pink, or one is about Pretty in Pink and one is about John Hughes. Pretty in Pink, there's a scene in which Harry Dean Stanton, the father, is talking to Molly Ringwald, and it's a very interesting scene because it's quite obviously shot in three different takes. And I know this because I would watch it with a friend of mine in college who would call out the takes based on the part of Harry Dean Stanton's hair. It'd be like, one... 1, 3, 2, 3, 1. The second factoid is in October of 2011, I traveled to suburban Chicago and punched John Hughes' grave.
True.
And as I did it, there is video documentation of this online. As I did it, I shouted out, "This is for Long Duck Dong. This is for Ducky." So, he got his. And of course, somebody said, "That's bad karma." I was like, "Yeah, I guess John Hughes III can always come and punch my grave." But you know what? I'll be dead and I won't care. So, I was originally going to read from the novelization of Spaceballs, as was Maggie. We were both really excited to read by the novelization of Spaceballs, written by Jovial Bob Stein. Thank you, Jovial Bob Stein, aka Robert R.L. Stein of Goosebumps fame. However, it's disappeared. Like, Maggie's copy never showed up. The copy that my girlfriend had disappeared. So this is the great white. This is the elusive quarry of this this series. Should it continue? If anybody comes along and does Spaceballs, that's a thing to remember. So instead, I will be reading from the novelization of a fine Bill Cosby vehicle called Ghost Dad. Bill Cosby, as you've never seen him before, dead. Oh, it actually says invisible. But so anyway, it's funny because this novelization starts out. It's like it's rife with foreshadowing. So the very first line: "Danny says I'm a haunt." Amanda Hopper said, "Is that true?" That is some real literary shit right there. So anyway, but it's interesting because there's I think that he really sort of taps into the author and of course the screenwriter, the Mel Sebulash. Mel Sebulash. Any fans of his work?
Yay!
Based on the screenplay by Chris Reason and Brent Maddock, they really tap into this sort of sense of alienation, Befremdungseffekt, I think is what it's called in German. I would like to read a little excerpt that sort of highlights what technology has done to us as people. And I will be reading the part of Bill Cosby in my best Jell-O pudding pop voice. "Father got up at once," he continued, "put on his slippers all the way." I'd just like to point out, I can't do a Bill Cosby. So you're just going to get the best I can do. "Put on his slippers and open the door. Right in front of him, he saw the ghost." He's reading a ghost story to his daughter. Or at least you think he is. "An old man with eyes red as burning coals, long gray hair coils, Russell. His garments were oily and ragged, and from his wrists hung heavy manacles and rusty chains. 'My dear sir,' said Father, 'I must really insist on your oiling those chains, as they have bought you, and have bought for you that purpose a small bottle of Tammany Rising Sun Lubricator.'" Amanda giggled. And almost as though the giggle were expected, there was a momentary pause in Elliot Hopper's performance. So skip ahead, and it turns out that she's been listening to a tape recorder of her father, because he's really busy working all the time so he can get the big promotion. So the father's tone changed. "Okay, honey bun," he remarked, "but that's enough for tonight. Sorry I had to work again late this weekend, but remember, it's just until Thursday. Now make me louder and hold me up to the door." So he pulls up to the door, and the tape recorder says, "Good night, Diane." Just goes ahead, and her Diane, the daughter, sort of has an interaction with her brother. He's like, "Well, what? I thought you were too cool to do this." And he's like, "Watch this." And then he pulls out a tape recorder of his own, and it presses play. And says, "Good night, Dad. I'll see you in the morning. Good talking to you." So this is sort of the alienation. Two human beings talking through technological devices, through recordings, sort of simulacrums of their own voice, instead of the real thing. This is sort of a terrifying thing to sort of presage Facebook and Facebook walls. Now I'd like to get to some of the physical comedy here. Here he is. He has forgotten his daughter's birthday. She's turning 17. And... So he has decided at the last minute, he's panicking, so he makes a cake out of a hat, and he covers it with whipped cream and puts a candle on top of it. Because he's like just going to be like, "Oh, here's a ha-ha, little funny thing." So he's coming, singing, "Happy birthday to you, happy birthday to you, happy birthday, dear," while Elliot cheerfully pretended to have forgotten Diane's name. He also continued his very slow-paced trip down the stairs. His lead foot seemed to be in line with an object several steps below, which would have considerably hastened his trip, one of Amanda's roller skates. So I can't tell if that's horror or if it's comedy that's happening right now. Diane laughingly provided the letter sound to his sister father. "Doris," he said, pausing to think, and then added,
Donna, Dolores, Dinosaur, Elliot sang, Diverticulitis. At the same moment, Elliot's song made Diane, Danny, and Amanda laugh out loud. Simultaneously, his lead foot settled on Amanda's roller skate. But, almost as if his luck had turned for the better, he stopped. Reaching down, he picked up the skate and said, Honey, don't leave your skates on the stairs.
Hilarious!
What a dry hump. So anyway, there's also a lot of other literary foreshadowing in this, foreshadowing. At one point, he nearly gets hit by a car. He nearly plummets to his death in an elevator. He nearly falls out a 12-story window. He nearly gets pushed out the same window by some workmen that are backing a piece of glass in. I don't know. They describe, like, they don't, apparently it's a very weird, who, he's not a ghost. He's still alive at this point. But he hasn't died. It just keeps on. I mean, I guess if you call it Ghost Dad, you know he's gonna die. So that just happens. So there's a great evidence of hubris where she's like, "Where is it? Let's see. Here we go. After all my years of sacrifice, putting my family on hold, my family's future will be secure." And with that, he stepped toward Carol. That move saved him from the huge pane of glass, but he and Carol hadn't even noticed it. You better not get run over by a bus Thursday, she said jokingly. So anyway, but the real best part of it comes when Bill Cosby finally meets his end. He gets into a cab that is driven by a Satanist. I'm not sure how many Satanists were really. I've never had a Satan. I mean, I've never had a Satanist. I kind of welcome the mix-up. Actually, it'd be a nice choice. But anyway, the driver turned toward the front of his cab. Elliot relaxed slightly and looked at the man's photo license posted on the dashboard. His name was Curtis Birch. Even though his photo was ugly and disgusting, it was accurate. Do you worship Satan? Asked the cabbie. Because, you know, that's what you do if you're going to proselytize. The question puzzled Elliot. For one thing, it was hard to believe it had come from the driver's mouth. For another thing, it was even harder to believe the man was asking Elliot this. Do I what? Elliot said incredulously. Do you accept Lord Satan as the supreme being? Do you accept evil as your salvation? Elliot gulped, realizing he was riding with a lunatic, and the lunatic was driving. Okay. I've always meant to get with this Satan stuff, Elliot said softly. But I've been busy. You know how things are like here. At that moment, the driver didn't even seem aware of Elliot or his words. His bloodshot eyes were fixed on the road ahead, and he was passing red lights faster than Elliot could count them. Finally, he turned toward Elliot, smiling, showing his yellow, stained teeth. I like you, he said. Now, do you worship Satan? Elliot considered leaping from the car. No, he decided it was going too fast. Bribery seemed like a better idea. He pulled out his wallet and said, How much do you want to stop this? Oh, I'm sorry. Jello pudding pop voice. How much do you want to stop this thing? The lunatic didn't respond. He seemed to be in a trance. Oh no, Elliot thought. He's becoming an idiot. I'll give you $20 to stop, Elliot called. In fact, you can make that $40. The lunatic responded by stepping down on the gas pedal. Are you a moron? Elliot mumbled. No, I take that back. Let's see. I have $76. You can have it all if you please stop the cab. The wild-eyed lunatic asked as if he hadn't heard the offer, and Elliot felt frightened. I'll throw in the wallet, he said. It's from Gucci. I'm sure it'll impress all your buddies in Satan's village, because... The lunatic grabbed the wallet and immediately stomped on the gas pedal. You stop this vehicle right now, Elliot roared. Do you worship Satan? Worship him? And this is where it gets great, because this is where Kaz finally admits. Elliot replied, decided to stop another approach. I am Satan, and I command you to stop. The news obviously distressed the madman driving, and he twisted around for another look at Elliot before he let out a terror-filled scream. Matching the scream, Elliot pointed at the bridge railing toward the cab racing. The cab driver hit the brake, but he'd acted too late. A second later, they slammed into the railing. The impact dumped Elliot onto the floor, and as the sound of glass breaking and steel crunching ended, he realized he had come through the crash unmarked.
He climbed up and looked into the front seat. The driver groaned but seemed all right. "Nice going, dimwit," Elliot replied sarcastically. "You could have killed us." The driver groaned again, and Elliot decided he'd had enough of this driver and the ride. I think he did, actually. "See you around," he announced. Because, you know, when you're walking away from a horrible accident, that's... "So long, everybody! See you next Tuesday!" "See you around," he announced, opening the door and stepping out. Okay, so I'll I gotta wrap up, so I'm just gonna skip ahead. Elliot shrieked in horror and reached for something to stop his fall. He opens the door and realizes he's dangling off a bridge. The cab was dangling precariously. Oh, wait, here we go. The cab was dangling precariously over the edge of a bridge, like I said. And Elliot was headed for the plunge of the river below. He managed to grab the door handle and lock his grip on it. Taking pains to move carefully, Elliot slowly inched his way back into the cab and slumped into the back seat. "Why do things like this have to happen to me?" he asked for no one in particular as he shifted his position. The car leaned with his movement, and the driver screamed. Elliot immediately shifted back to his previous spot, and the cab moved with him. "Okay," he told the driver, "now try to be calm." "Yes, evil master." Elliot couldn't believe his ears. The man was definitely a moron. I think we've ascertained that. There was no sense trying to pretend he was only a lunatic. Okay. Elliot cautiously eyed the driver, who eyed Elliot's wallet in front of the passenger seat. "Master," he said, reaching across the seat, "your wallet." "No, don't move." "It's a Gucci," the driver said, continuing to lean across the seat. "No," Elliot cried, "it's a fake, an imitation. It was made in Hackensack." Oh no, Elliot thought, as the cab slid sideways slightly before slanting toward the river. A moment later, it slammed into the water and disappeared below the surface. Does he make it? Only Ghost Dad can tell you. Thank you. Thank you, Joe Garden. What I love about that movie is it's a movie about a ghost dad. That a dad is a ghost. And that is like the least unbelievable thing that we just heard in the whole plot. I'd say this cab driver, that is what we call some good writing. Speaking of good writing, we got another onion guy coming to the stage. He's gonna read from a book, ladies and gentlemen, a good friend of mine and yours, Mr. Todd Hansen.
Part of Liam's novella series, and I'm going to be reading from one of my favorite novellas, Ross Law's Prince of Abyssinia by Dr. Samuel Johnson. "Ye who listen with credulity to the whispers of fancy and pursue with eagerness the phantoms of hope, who expect that age will perform the promises of youth and that the deficiencies of the present day will be supplied by the morrow, attend to the history of Rasselas, Prince of Abyssinia." What? Sorry. Oh. It's embarrassing. This is the novelizations, not the novellas. That was a different, totally different reading series that I have. Luckily, I have a novelization in my hands as well. This is one of the greatest of the novelizations. It's a long-neglected art form that has fallen into, I don't want to say disuse in recent years, but certainly a lack of popular appreciation. This is the second Travolta novelization that we're going to be hearing from tonight, but it's actually... it's much more significant in the history of the novelization than the Grease novelization, because Travolta had already proven himself as a literary figure by the time the Grease novelization was released. But at this time, this was his this was his debut in the literary world of prose. And so, for all we know, the Grease novelization may never have even occurred if it hadn't have been for H.B. Gilmore, who wrote this novel based on a screenplay by Norman Wexler, and who himself had based his screenplay on a story by Nick Cohn. So it's actually kind of three people that contributed to this work of literature. Before I get into it, though, I'd like to just share a few thoughts with you. The first is, I have some just reactions to the show so far. The first is Pretty in Pink. Whenever someone tells me that's one of their favorite movies, it's just like, seriously, fuck off. That movie is evil. That movie is so fucking evil because it ends with her getting with the other guy who's the villain that they changed after they did a test marketing, and she gets together with the villain, supposed to be happy. Bullshit. She's supposed to get together with Ducky. Everybody knows that. The fact that she didn't get together with Ducky. So, like, seriously, fuck Pretty in Pink. Some Kind of Wonderful, he picks the right girl. Pretty in Pink, not so much. Not so much. Secondly, I just want to share this thought, which someone, apparently everyone here doesn't ever leave the house, you know, and is on Facebook. Like, apparently, like, we would have social lives if it wasn't for Facebook. It's sad. Apparently, it's evident this whole evening wouldn't exist if it wasn't for Facebook. But earlier today on Facebook, somebody, my friend Jeffrey P. Worthen, shared this thought regarding the novelization of Saturday Night Fever. One of the great examples of Kunstlerroman in American literature. Gilmore, Wexler, and Cohn were the intellectual and weave the intellectual and religio-philosophical awakenings of young Tony Manero as it begins to question and rebel against the Brooklyn-bred Italian-American conventions with which he has been raised. It's my friend Jeffrey P. Worthen, and I had to actually look up Kunstlerroman. It's a subgenre. Of the Bildungsroman, which is a coming-of-age story, but the Kunstlerroman is the coming-of-age of a young artist who finds his identity through art, in this case, that art being the art of the dance. So, now I would like to read, and it's wonderful to be in Brooklyn while we read this. So this is just setting the stage. This is a preface by the great H.B. Gilmore. Well, actually, before I even get in, I just want to read the extra textual aspects of the book, the cover copy. It's very important. It says, a major motion picture from Paramount. That's the first thing you read before you get anything else. That is, of course, the most important thing about it. And then it says, a novel by H.B. Gilmore, screenplay by Norman Wexler, based on a true story by Nick Cohn. And at the bottom, the best, fantastic full-color centerfold out. They couldn't decide whether to use the word fold out or centerfold, so they just combined them into one word, centerfold out. Fantastic full color centerfold out of John Travolta inside. Really? No, that couldn't be the case. Is it really? Is there an actual centerfold out of John Travolta? Yes, there is. There's five different images of John Travolta dancing. So as soon as you finish masturbating to one, you move right. You got four more shots before the book loses its interest for you. I also want to read you the back. It says, where do you go when the record is over? ... John Travolta is Tony. He's 19. Sexy. Lives in Brooklyn. Works in Brooklyn. Saturday night, he goes dancing. He's the disco king, capital D, capital K. He meets Stephanie. She's 20, beautiful, different from all the other girls in Brooklyn. The best dancer Tony's ever seen. Will she be his disco queen, capital D, capital Q? Will they go on dancing? Even after the record is over? Saturday Night Fever. Prologue. Everything is changing. The rainbow spray of lights across the disco floor captures rapture. Immediately goes with the full-on alliteration of the assonance and alliteration. It's not actually alliteration, it's more assonance, but the point is it's capture and rapture. One letter off. Both words in a row. coming out the gate swinging, not even holding anything back. The rainbow spray of lights across the disco floor captures rapture, splashing from face to waist to hands, carving rhythms in the multicolored space. We got to read that sentence again. The rainbow spray of lights across the disco floor captures rapture, splashing from face to waist to hands, carving rhythms in the multicolored space. You almost wish that H.B. Gilmore had written the poetization rather than the novelization. The blinding, bouncing white spots hit the tiers of tables behind the dance floor, freeze the speed-driven action for a second, then release their hostages contemptuously. Dark. Dark. You know, it's people disco dancing. But no, the strobe lights, the blinding, bouncing white spots hit the tiers of tables behind the dance floor, freeze the speed-driven action just for a second, and frozen in motion, and then they release their hostages with contempt. So we're not, this is not just some trifling thing. This is serious drama on the disco floor. On the other side of the, excuse me, just a second. It's too fucking hot up here. It's too fucking hot up here, but it's about to get hotter. On the other side of the room, Bernie, the DJ, is high in his control booth, high on his fantasy of control. I just have to say to the guys in the control booth, are you high on your fantasy of control right now? He's nodding. He's nodding. He knows, H.B. Gilmore, he understands how it feels to be you. God inside your head. He plays the music you move to. He makes you go crazy or slow. And every once in a while, he howls through his mic so you don't forget just who is the whiz of the 2001 Odyssey Ballroom. But down at the first and best tier, ringside, the faces, capital F, the faces, that means the disco kings, the elite of the disco club, know who really owns the place. Ask them and they'll probably laugh and lay you out. Who's the disco king? What, are you kidding? Tony. Tony Manero. Bobby C. is sitting at the only reserved table with his pad and pencil out. He's sketching a gum-popping, heavy-knockered chick a table away. That's heavy-knockered with a hyphen. I've heard 9 million variations on the adjective big-titted, but I've never heard heavy-knockered. And I think H.B. Gilmore coined that, and I think he deserves credit for coming up with heavy-knockered chick a table away. Her chewing is synced to the music. Her eyes are half-lids. Her mouth motion says she's on speed, but her lids say lewds. Her breasts say women's lib has reached Bay Ridge, Brooklyn. Hyphen. But they lie. Not only can her breasts talk, they can lie. Bobby C. can spot the golden Jesus cross hanging right between those big lion braless boobs. And where there's a cross, there's a stiff penalty for penetration. Oh, sweet Jesus, Bobby C. remembers miserably. What the hell's he gonna do about Pauline? Hot, dumb, ugly as they come, and probably pregnant, Pauline. Crosses. Catholic broads. They should cross their legs. But ask Bobby C., who's the king of 2001 Odyssey Ballroom? Who gets pick of the pussy? Who always gets a chance to dance in the backseat? Ask Double J. He's sitting next to Bobby C., looking for action, always. His young, scarred fist is wrapped around a glass, and he's wishing it was a neck or ass or something to tear into. Double J's meaner than he's pretty, and that makes him mighty mean. Evidently, by implication, He's very pretty, man. Ask Joey the pug. He's built like a fire plug, only the kind you definitely do not piss on. Ask any of the faces sprawled around the only reserved table. Double J, Gus the slightly round clown, Joey, or Bobby C. It's Saturday night and everything's changing behind the splashing disco lights, behind the pills, poppers, and vodka, behind the music and sights of frenzied tits and ass hustling, behind the pants riding cherry high. I don't even know what that means. Cherry high? Your pants are riding cherry high? What? How high is cherry high? Like, so they're, like, that low? So they're riding cherry low. Anyway, the pants are riding cherry. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have broken the flow of the prose. I apologize. We're behind the pants, riding cherry high. And he's moving among them. Tony Manero, who could have it all for a dance. Ask anyone who comes to 2001 steady. Hey, who's the tough cool always gets the best table? How come the girls ask him to dance? So he's pretty when he smiles. He moves slow and talks low. And he glows, man, out on the floor. When he dances, he's gone. And even who he's with doesn't exist. He's just this flowing, flawless, non-homosexual body. Like a ripple of music, like a spray of light, he's Tony, quote, heterosexual man, unquote, Manero. Only 18, the disco king. And while he's dancing, everything's changing. Even the day, because it's just about midnight. Saturday to Sunday is one beat away. And sometimes Tony can dance so fine and hard, he forgets that everything around him is changing. Book hasn't even hit chapter one! I don't want to give any spoiler alerts. You may have seen the film, but you probably have not read the novelization. It's a different art form. It's a different thing. I don't want to give it away. So instead, I'm just going to read from Hard Hats, Rednecks, and Macho Men, Class in 1970s American Cinema by Derek Nystrom, assistant professor of English at McGill University, who has this to say about Saturday Night Fever. Indeed, the preeminent problem facing fever is that disco music and nightclubs were strongly identified with gay men in the mid-1970s. If Bay Ridge is understood by the film as a neighborhood where the values of the 1950s are still dominant, the dance floor of 2001 is nevertheless a space that could connote more contemporary and less heterocentric gender and sexual norms. The dilemma for Fever's heterosexual romance is compounded by the fact that much of the film's visual pleasure is derived from its strategy of making a male body, John Travolta, as an object of the camera's gaze, a strategy that, as a good deal of feminist film theory suggests, threatens the heterosexual stability of the implicitly male spectator. Therefore, I take Fever's central representational problem to be its attempt to craft a heterosexual narrative out of cultural resources and filmic practices that would seem better suited to gay male themes. The hurdles that the film must clear and the tactics it must use in order to do so end up telling us a great deal about the surprising centrality of social class to the articulation of gender and sexual identity in this period. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Todd Hanson. Let's give it up. So we're reaching the end of the literary portion of program. I just want to say something about Pretty in Pink. There was some shit talked about Pretty in Pink. Just so you know, the novelization was written and based on the screenplay in which Ducky and Andy end up together. So I'm not quite sure where that came from. Who's coming out next?
I don't know. You tell me.
Okay, fine. There is a show I used to watch at my grandma's house because we didn't have cable. I went to my grandma's house to watch cable. And one of the shows that I used to watch in the morning was Mystery Science Theater 3000. I had one friend in high school, or when I was in middle school or high school, who was like, okay, you need to watch these shows, Kids in the Hall, Mystery Science Theater 3000, and Late Night with Conan O'Brien. So those were the three things that I like was told were funny, three. So Mystery Science Theater 3000 has been dear to my heart since I was really young, and I'm very happy to announce that we are bringing out Mr. TV's Frank Conniff.
Yeah! Or should you say novelizations, Frank Conniff? It's a whole new world, ladies and gentlemen. And I don't feel old, but I love hearing that you watch me at your grandma's house. I'm very grateful. Excuse me, but I was handed this novelization just as I walked in. It's called Krull. I don't know if you're familiar with Krull. It's from the early 80s. It was a fantasy film, I think, that was made in the wake of the success of Star Wars and The Empire Strikes Back. And it came out at a time that that has come to be known as the beginning of the golden age of adult male virginity. And this was a fantasy. It didn't do quite as well as there weren't like a string of Krull movies, unfortunately. And I noticed on the cover, it says a novel, doesn't say a novelization, it says a novel by Alan Dean Foster, who was a very, a big guy in the world of novelization. Seriously, I think he did a lot of the Lucas novelizations. He was like kind of the first guy they went to, I think, for sci-fi novelization. So in other words, he was known for his own work as a science fiction writer, but he was successful enough at that to be known, but still needed the money to do novelizations. And then, so it says a novel by Alan Dean Foster, and then screenplay by Stanford Sherman. And so I think that gives you an idea of Alan Dean Foster's status in the world of novelization, which they didn't want to say based on a screenplay by Stanford Sherman. They just wanted to say, it's novel by, screenplay by, they just happened to be written at the same time. and an interesting thing about Krull, at least to me, is that it's directed by Peter Yates, who was this really terrific, very versatile director. He directed Bullet with Steve McQueen, which is a really good movie. He directed Breaking Away, which was a beautiful, sensitive story about bicycle racing, which seems inconceivable now. There are no evil people with just one ball in this movie. It was a whole different era back then. And I have to point out, I'm obsessed with this one movie that Peter Yates made, which is a great movie, made in 1973 with Robert Mitchum, called The Friends of Eddie Coyle. If you ever get a chance, I recommend it, but I just have to say, it's the most depressing fucking movie ever made. On purpose, it's depressing, it's bleak, nothing good happens to anybody in the movie, and that's why I'm very fond of it. But, so I haven't seen the movie, Krull yet, but that's all right with me because I like reading the novelizations first, so then when I see the movie I can make sure that they're very true to the novelization. And I like annoy all my friends. I'm like that annoying guy who you go to a movie with everyone is like, yeah, that was good. And I'm like, wasn't as good as a novelization. Oh yeah, Frank. He never likes. Same thing with the G.I. Joe movies. Like, the toy was much better. So untrue to the toy. But anyway, I picked a chapter at random because... I scanned over it in the back of the room, and it looks pretty exciting. So I'm just going to read from some of it here. This is chapter 4. How it works. No, just chapter 4. Their journey. Okay. Should I get into some kind of a literary? I've always wanted to do a literary reading in Brooklyn, by the way, so this is exciting. And that's the weird thing. This book has an introduction by Jonathan Lethem, which I never would have thought. But So, chapter 4. Their journey took them through a mountain pass rarely traversed by the citizens of That's the thing about fantasies. Everything has a really fucked up name that you can't even say. It's E-I-R-ing, yeah, whatever. And that's the thing I think about what must be great about being writing fantasy novels is that if you run out of inspiration, you can just vamp for 2 chapters, just making up words. Yes, this is the sword of Mongrongo, and the Pockentink of Lilimlach can come to the Postervant of Panrinstroix. Now go on your quest, you know. So their journey took... Okay, soon they once more enjoyed the company of evergreens and berry bushes. Hello. Thank you. I love that. Birds and insects filled the airways between the trees, reminding Colwyn that he belonged to the world of the living. Hey, man, I hear you, buddy. A lot of times I have to be reminded that I belong to the world of the living. It happens way too often in my deep clinical depressions. But the serenity of the forest was deceiving. He knew that at any instant it could be crushed to pulp at the beast's whim, as could any part of Krull. I have no idea what that means, but those of you who've seen the movie probably can picture all this. They followed a stream downhill, stopping beside a low bank, which is good. There was an ATM machine there to say, where the water slowed and dozed, forming a small pool. Okay, this is an even more fucked up name. How is anyone supposed to say this? Y-N-Y-R. Nyr-nyr. When the guy wrote the screenplay, he didn't know it was going to be an alibi, so it wasn't going to be an issue that they would have to read these names. Dismounted and went to draw himself a drink while his companion fiddled with the glaive. That's probably a real thing. I just don't know what it is. So I'm not saying anything about that. Like any sensible outrider, Colwyn carried leather strips and clamps for repair. Ooh. Yeah, this is ahead of its time. Look at that. Sure, this isn't in the West Village, am I right, people? Come on. Now he utilized them to fashion a carrying strap and protective pouch for the glaive. So he could carry it slung from his belt. He did not trust it to the saddlebags, and there might come a time when having it close at hand could save a life. You know, that's an exciting chapter. I just read it pretty shitty. As the pouch neared completion... Oh, I didn't know this about this movie. There's a lot of pouch-making scenes in this. As it neared completion, they show you the whole process of making a pouch. It's very educational. As the pouch neared completion, a peculiar aroma caught his attention. He sniffed. Nearby, the tethered horses stirred uneasily. Something singed the evening air. His eyes widened as something spun wildly past him, causing him to back instinctively. Merely looked interested. I'm glad someone was interested. At first, Colwyn, who, by the way, had a whole troop called the Colwyn Follies, thought it might be a hare or some other small game thrown aside by a hidden predator. He was positive he saw the face of a fox in the whirling shape. Or were those deer legs? Elk antlers. The hind end of a steer. And the startled face of a globus all mixed together, spinning round and round, with human limbs and features. All Colwyn could think was, wow, this is going to go over great at Comic-Con. Well, that isn't in the... And by the way, if any of you have never been to Comic-Con, they have one in New York and in San Diego. It's actually, I recommend it, it's actually a great thing. It's a place where people who are into science fiction, fantasy, comic books can meet other people with type 2 diabetes. So it's a really great thing. This stuff is so weird. I was about to read the same paragraph again. Eventually, this aerial confusion came to rest with a violent splash. The smell and sound vanished, and he found himself standing next to the pool, confronting a young man of small stature. The visitor lay face down in the pool, kicking and flailing at the water. "Help, help, I'm drowning!" He said he was small, so I assumed he had that kind of... "Help, help, I'm drowning!" That was really prejudice of me to say that, to do it that way. Colwyn leaned forward, resting his right arm on his thigh as he studied the new arrival. "I doubt it. The water you're lying in is barely a foot deep." This is the point in the movie where the music goes, wah, 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 which always works in a fantasy movie. At this, the stranger ceased his excretions. Okay. Guess this was the number 2 movie when it opened. And rolled over. He sat straight and wiped at the mud on his shirt, muttering to himself. His hair was stringy and long, and his attitude as tart as a pickled herring. Suddenly there's delicatessen references. He was as vicious as a pastrami sandwich. Slowly he rose, step by step, inch by inch. No, it doesn't say that. Slowly he rose, still striving to divest himself of the gain so recently and ignobliously, however you say that word, acquired. "Well, it could have been quicksand. I might have been dragged down to my death while you stood there gawking. This is not the reaction of a friend." He waded soggily out of the pool, kicking first one leg and then another, like a dog trying to shed water. He eyed his surroundings warily. "Where is this place?" You're really interested, aren't you? "A forest near the foothills of the Granite Mountain, on the far side from the kingdom of Earing Turingjordain." The little man frowned at him. "What the fuck kind of a place is that now?" The little man frowned at him. "Now I know of the kingdom of Yuring, and I've heard of Fartorlanjord, but Yuring Chorosov I know nothing of. There has been a merging made. The kingdoms have been joined." Well, there's a lot of stuff about civic merging of municipalities. "Well, I am underwhelmed. The Granite Mountain, you say?" Colwyn added. "Blast and frog jumps. 1,000 miles off course." He shrugged sadly. "Well, I was rushed. There was a certain difference of opinion concerning a gooseberry trifle." I'm sure if you had, they set up the gooseberry trifle earlier, I'm sure. And this is like a funny payoff to that. "The foolish man left it sitting, isolated and friendless on his windowsill, poor thing. What did you expect?" "Perhaps," Goldwyn speculated, "he expected to eat it." That's how people laughed in those days. No one ever just laughed. They always, if anyone laughed, it was always... But anyway, this is all incomprehensible to me. I'm just going to say, as I leave, that I didn't come up here to make fun of this or to put it down, even though that's what I kind of did, but... Because you people really enjoyed my reading of this, and the last time I performed here doing my own material, I fucking ate it. So thank you very much.
Give it up for TV Strength. Am I crazy, or was there like a Golden Globus reference snuck into the text there? Did I catch that, or am I...
Goldwyn.
Yeah, but I felt like you couldn't come out and say Golden Globus. All right, Todd, we can actually just talk about this later. Like one-on-one. So that is the reading portion of the show. Thank you, everybody. It's not the end of the show. We have one more act, but... Those are all the novelizations. Can we hear it for the readers we heard? What do you think, Heidi? You want to do this again?
Yeah, I think would you guys come see this again? We thought so. No, I mean, we were going to do another one even before anyone came, but, you know. go ahead.
I'm sorry. Before we introduce our final act, I just want to say again, Marlo, Heidi, I'm Liam. Let's hear it for Frank and Todd and Joe and Maggie.
And Facebook.
The time waster that wastes everybody's time. But ladies and gentlemen, we have an amazing fucking musical act to round out the evening. Are you a fan of the act or just music?
Music.
Oh, sweet. Well, then you're going to have a really good time because you're going to hear some.
Yeah, and there, you know, you kind of have to ask someone who's really game for it. Like, hey, do you want to do this weird thing that we've never done before and we don't know if anyone's going to come, and do you want to maybe write something original for it? That's not a good sell. Like, no one wants to do that. But these guys stepped up to the plate, so should I do it? Should I say it? Introduce them?
Are you ready, Mar?
All right,
buddy.
Handjob Academy.
Handjob Academy.
Handjob Academy, you like those novelizations? Y'all about to drop your asses for us?
Check. We're a rap group.
That's right.
I think we're about to do a track about...
It's based on a little girl's diary.
Twin Peaks.
It's about Twin Peaks.
It's about the diary of Laura Palmer.
Sick shit. I like to see my bitches dead, baby girl. You wanna go home with me?
True.
Then I'll slit your wrist, kill your ass.
I'm good.
Yeah, my dog has something to tell you.
Dear diary. I'm gonna blow a line real quick, guys. Hold on. Get down with it. It's all good.
Yeah. You might want to
high five. Yeah, I said it with the fucking Laura Palmer. She looking kind of purple, but I guess I still love her because I bust my bitches dead like the sun in the night. The bottom and I'll let top.
Twin Peaks.
My truck is that's where I let this body bag drop. Float down the river. Cocaine in a bag. I killed Donna, Audrey, Shelley, and that witch with an eye patch. I want it dead in my house. Nobody caught it pouring up because I stuffed her in the doghouse. Agent Cooper. Ain't no mystery on my block. I put all the limbs in my safety deposit box. Hiding in the tree at the funeral. You best leave soon because I'm a digger up and stuff a dildo in a tomb.
Ew.
All these bitches walk around.
Only one.
invited to my brothel fortress. Make his dick stiff like rigor mortis. Oh, motel life, a slob on his knob. Whisper sweet nothings in his ear all night. Bop, bop, bop. Hand job, bitch. Don't prod, yo. Check it out. I'ma give you a manicure underneath your nail bed. Cocaine cowgirl, white and green. Cocaine cowgirl, white and green. A cocaine cowgirl, white and green. The owls aren't what they seem. No. Novelizations, they're just tracks.
They're just regular.
Yeah. But we want y'all to get down with it anyway. Because we don't usually play for a lot of people like this, so it's fun.
A captive audience.
Yeah. Bitch, get off my clit. Bitch, get off my clit.
Sing it, Jesco.
Bitch, get off. Bitch, get off. Bitch, get off my.
Velvet. Hands up if you smell this. Get off my clit and gyrate your pelvis. Got you wetter than the wettest hurricane weather. Cut from the same cloth, birds of a feather. Yank to the yang. You can't even hold a candle to my flame. Your dick hole is what I put my fist through. You say you're the sun, but I'm here to eclipse you. Banana to a chip, hoe to a pimp. I walk with a limp, so bitch, get off my clit.
Bitch, get off my clit.
Okay.
Bitch, get off my clit. Bitch, get off, bitch, get off, bitch, get off my.
Oh my god, banging pandas. That's what you're gonna resemble when I black both your eyes. Bitch, I go a panda, as in Knox. Bitch, still the boss. All you bitch ass haters feel me deep in your crevasse. Oops, I'm in crevasse. You're not charming, so get out my ass. Little darling, cause extreme reactions in warring factions when I divide and conquer your ass like it's fractions. Action, I'd like to thank the Academy.
You're welcome.
Better than Miss Jane Calamity, lyrical gunslinger, shark week chum bringer. Got you wildin' out like Amish kids on Bump Springer.
Bitch, get off my clit.
Okay.
Little bitch, get off my clit. Bitch, get off, bitch, get off, bitch, get off my clit.
Yo, I ain't no little child. I'm an adult.
If you gon' be frontin', that's your own damn fault. I'm passing women like I used to. Piss on your girlfriend, flood your house up. You think I was a whirlwind away? I come at you, snatch your old lady, take a gold ring off when she's screaming, oh baby, I get out my house. I'm serious this time, don't want no drama, cause I'll commit the crime. It's like my pastime bird snitches in my backyard. Your ass so big, looking like a tub of lard, and I'm hard to see. No, I ain't transparent. Gotta lay a history for no Republican parents, and I don't wanna meet your mom and pop. Got my old pop Billy Pig looking ass, told me to watch my tone. Pop off, I ain't got time for your shit. When it's time for the next one, I say, bitch, get off my clip. Bitch, get off my clip.
Girls, wow.
I always think more like a toxic girl at pubs. They don't wanna give me no hugs, but I gotta bump with the shit you need, cause you a motherfucking drug addict. I think no, I'm not what I think, cause I'm fucking crazy. No smoke, no green, but a motherfucking lazy attitude, and I'm on display. Shut your pothole, let it run through your veins. I'm a vegetarian, don't eat no meat. But baby girl, I will eat your meat. Same birthday, this machine gon' kill it. April 22nd, 1990. Careful, you in my state on it. Glass of milk, with your titties on it. Driving around, my whole city's on it. My tongue is explicit, ain't it? Cause I'ma take it to the mouth. Take it to the stars, cause I'm Pope Heron and my nose now ball. And I'm not a boy, so I can't be a boyfriend. But if you want me to, then I can be your cousin. There you go, that's Django.
Django, ho.
There you go, that's Django.
I'm a Django, ho.
Yo,
I fuck Dale Cooper though.
Oh, yeah, bitch, call me D-Lo. Yeah, bitch, call me D-Lo. I'm a wild girl. I'm a wild girl. I'm a wild girl. Fuck a date, I need a hoe. Yeah, bitch, call me D-Lo. Yeah, bitch, call me D-Lo. I'm a wild girl. I'm a wild girl.
One show, one night in Brooklyn. It's Tell Your Friends, the concert film, capturing some of New York City's best and brightest alternative comedians in their natural habitat, including Reggie Watts, Kurt Braunohler and Kristen Schaal, Christian Finnegan, Leo Allen, Rob Paravonian, and Liam McEnany.
Okay, what is funnier, the Holocaust or slavery? And again, don't pick your favorite.
We gotta get you out of these clothes.
Yeah, show me how, John Smith.
Well, first I'm gonna take off your buffalo skins.
Mm-hmm. Take them off. I don't like my buffalo skins.
And there you go. You're totally naked now.
Well, I don't want to make you feel bad. You were looking at a former Danny Zuko from the musical Grease. Right here. So, yeah. And I was Little Abner. And I was in an all-white production of The Wiz. Oh, yeah. that's the way New England does it. If they put up a sign that says rough road, they're pretty much admitting they're never going to fix the road. By the same token, we don't have money for education. We'll just put a sign by the school that says slow children.
That's Tell Your Friends the Concert Film, coming December 4th to digital download sites everywhere, streaming sites, video on demand, and A Special Thing Records. TellYourFriendsMovie.com. That's it. That was a long one, but we made it through, guys. I hope you enjoyed it. If anyone's still listening, that is a 2-hour show. It was great, but it was 2 hours. Next week's episode, as I said, Stephen Tobolowsky. And I think that's it. Tell your friends, everybody, the only podcast that matters.